Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and perhaps you heard Michael Lewis has a new book. And if you hadn't heard, you might be interested to know that there's still a missing plane in the Indian Ocean. The Obamacare deadline came and went, and the Mets stink at baseball so far this year. For a book that the publisher claims it didn't do too much advance press about, Lewis's Flash Boys sure is getting a lot of attention. On Tuesday, we counted three different articles in the New York Times alone. And along with the attention the book is getting is the conversation about the world of high-frequency trading that it describes. Michael Lewis has said that this book, more than his others, is intended to expose wrongdoing and lead to change. And we're just getting word this morning that Attorney General Eric Holder will be looking into the world of high-frequency trading to see if it does violate insider trading laws. So 5 days into the Michael Lewis Flash Boys era, let's check in on how Wall Street and Washington are reacting to the book, and we'll try to take a step back and explain what high-frequency trading is in the first place for the many of you, including me, who are confused. Felix Salmon is finance blogger at Reuters and our designated Wall Street explainer guy for today. Felix, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian.
And one thing that's become clear is that high-frequency trading is becoming a catch-all for all sorts of behavior. That much I get. So you want to start with your baseline definition of what high-frequency trading is and isn't?
Do I have to? I don't have one, to be honest. And what you generally find in this debate is that the term means whatever you want it to mean. So when Michael Lewis uses it, although to his credit, he's saying that he doesn't like using the term either because it is so vague and it can mean so many different things. The people who like it just say it's the way that we can jump into the markets and provide liquidity and make them faster and more efficient. The people who hate it say it's a way of front-running the market and skimming billions of dollars off of poor, innocent investors' stock market orders. And the truth is all of the above, really. It means everything from – but I think at the heart what it means is just – anyone with computers which trade stocks really quickly.
And we're going to play a clip in a minute of Michael Lewis on 60 Minutes. To understand this clip, I think you have to understand one of the concepts that he writes about, which is front running. What is front running?
Front running, what Michael Lewis complains about is that if you want to buy 100,000 shares of IBM and you can see there's a person offering the 100,000 shares of IBM on the stock exchange somewhere because that's, you know, on your screens. And you say, I'll take those shares. But after you hit the button saying, I'll take those shares, a bunch of high-frequency traders jump into the market very quickly, kind of ahead of you. They can smell your order, or they can see your order coming, or they can just move faster than you. And they either take those shares away from the market or buy them up and then sell them to you at a higher price. And they basically stop you from buying the shares which you wanted to buy, and you wind up paying more than you originally thought you would have to pay.
That is amazing that they can smell that out like that and jump ahead of you like that. So here is Michael Lewis on 60 Minutes honing in on how high-frequency trading enables that front running. Here he's describing the practice as it happened to a trader named Brad. You will also hear Steve Croft in this clip, but it starts with Michael Lewis.
Brad realizes, oh my God, that's how I'm being front run. I'm being front run because my signal gets to the BATS exchange first, and they can beat me to all the other exchanges.
It only took a tiny fraction of a second for Brad's trade to reach the next exchanges on the network. But the high-speed traders were able to jump in front of him, buy the same stock, and drive the price up before his order arrived, producing a small profit of just one or two pennies. But it was happening to everyone's trades millions of times a day.
That adds up. You make it sound like a skim.
What else would you call it?
So the rules of the game can change, the same thing you were describing, between when somebody wants to buy a stock and someone actually gets it, which can be a fraction of a millisecond. But is that really a thing?
Yes, it's really a thing. And it's something which big investors have been complaining about for many years now. They say that they're finding it much, much harder to get filled on big orders without winding up paying essentially a tax to these high-frequency shops.
How does it happen? How do they know? If I'm if I'm doing something online for a trade, or if I have a broker and they're going to put in a trade, how do these guys know?
Well, let's be clear about this, because this is quite important. This doesn't affect you. If you have an E-Trade account, or if you're phoning up your broker and saying, I want 3 shares of Google at $600 each, this doesn't affect you.
Because I'm a tiny little guppy.
Because you're a tiny little guy, and your order will never even reach any of the stock exchanges. Now, we think that there are only two. There's the New York Stock Exchange and there's the NASDAQ. In fact, there's dozens of them. And there's lots of different places. There are dark pools. It gets complicated very quickly. But there are lots and lots of stock exchanges, and your order for just a handful of shares, maybe $1,000 or so, won't hit any of them. The people who are getting hurt by high-frequency trading is big traders like Brad in your clip, who is trying to buy millions and millions of dollars worth of stock at once. The people who benefit, actually, are the small traders, the individuals. They get filled immediately. They get exactly the price that they're being shown.
But how do they know about Brad?
How does Michael Lewis know about Brad? Because he's
no. How do the front runners know about Brad and get in ahead of his trade that he's just now placing?
So that was what the clip was about. Because there are so many exchanges, because there are dozens of exchanges, what happens is that Brad puts in his order. It goes to one exchange first. And then if the order gets filled in that one exchange, great. And if it can't get filled in that exchange, it gets passed on from that exchange to all of the other exchanges.
But by then somebody can see it.
Exactly.
In an interview with Bloomberg this week, Lewis tried to clarify the difference between what he calls computer trading and computer scalping. Is that an important distinction?
It is if you want to take a certain part of the market and effectively outlaw it, which is Michael Lewis's effectively his big campaign right now. He doesn't want to ban all computers from the stock market. That would be unrealistic and unfeasible and unwise. He just wants to ban certain types of computers from doing certain types of things. And he doesn't really believe in a regulatory solution to this problem, because he thinks that whenever you impose that kind of a regulatory solution, smart people on Wall Street will find a way around it and use that regulation to just make even more money. What he likes is Brad's private sector solution, which is something called the Investors Exchange, or IEX. He reckons there's this new kind of stock exchange which works against high-frequency traders, and if people just moved their orders to the IEX or exchanges which follow in its footsteps, then a lot of this problem will go away. So he wants certain types of trading to go away, and Brad has created an exchange which makes those certain types of trade much more difficult to effectuate.
Listeners, questions about what you've been hearing about Michael Lewis and Flash Boys and the issues that he raises and want Felix Salmon to explain, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And is this new? I mean, there have been reports on high-frequency trading for years. I'd say a lot of people we know first heard about it on, after the so-called flash crash of 2010, or on WNYC's own show Radiolab, which did a story about it 2 years ago. So are there particularly new revelations in Lewis's book, or is it just bringing it to a bigger audience?
There was nothing particularly new or surprising to me in the book, except that he's proposing a solution. I think that's the new thing in the book. Before the book came out, really no one had heard of IEX. People knew about high-frequency trading. They knew about the problem. But what they didn't know is that there's this new small baby exchange out there called IEX, which could be part of the solution. And that I think, is the news in the book.
And Josh tweeted us, quote, "Amazingly, physical proximity of high-frequency trading servers to exchange servers makes a lucrative microseconds difference, too." And that's his tweet. And that's right? Lewis writes in his book about the efforts to build super-fast, super-straight cables through mountains in Pennsylvania that connect different exchanges. So is it weirdly back to physical proximity given how high tech is supposed to make all of that irrelevant?
We are talking about instances of time which are so unbelievably fast that you are literally constrained by the speed of light. So that if you build a cable which goes particularly straight, or even a set of microwave towers which go particularly straight between Chicago and New York, you can communicate between those two cities more quickly. Or if you want to talk to a certain stock exchange, if you have a computer server which is what's known as co-located, if it's physically in the same place as the stock exchange, it can trade a little bit more faster because the cables are shorter and, you know, information can only travel down the cable at the speed of light. And that's how crazy it gets.
Crazy. And John in Manhattan has an anecdote about that, I think. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, I listened to the author speaking, Terry Gross, and he was fascinated. He said that there was a trader or organization that spent $200 million to lay a cable as directly as possible, a direct line between Chicago and the trading center, which is in New Jersey, which is what the Wall Street uses.
Right, and that's the same one I mentioned, where the cables go through mountains in Pennsylvania to make it, you know, a millisecond shorter of transmission time. Bob in Oakland, New Jersey, has a different question. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Brian. I forget my ignorance on the subject of economics here, but to refer to the people who are basically skimming off the top of these transactions as these guys, and I'm really curious, who are these guys, or what organizations or groups do they represent?
Felix?
Good question. And actually, Michael Lewis's book is quite good on this. They're in large part Russian computer programmers, interestingly enough. But the big names, the names change. This is not an area where there's a small group of named companies or named individuals who have been just extracting these rents. Back in the early days, it was a company called Getco. Then there were other companies called with names like Citadel and Knight. It's much smaller companies generally. Knight, of course, famously blew up a couple of years ago when the NASDAQ changed its trading rules and lost $400 million in the space of a few minutes and then had to get rescued by Getco, and it's a bit of an afterthought now. The technology arms race here is so intense that very few companies really stay on top for any significant length of time. And it's so intense that no big organization, none of the big banks are particularly good at it. This is a point that Michael Lewis makes in his book. The great high-frequency traders don't tend to work for Goldman Sachs or Credit Suisse. They work for themselves. It doesn't take a huge amount of money by Wall Street standards. It takes a few $1 million, and you can do it for yourself. You're not taking outside investors. You can do it very quietly. And the people who are winning, change from month to month.
So you said that Lewis really is writing, or we talked about how he has been very clear that he's really hoping with this book, more than his others, to spur actual change. What do you think the chances of actual policy change happening are as a result of this book? We do hear today that Eric Holder has announced, as Attorney General of the United States, he's going to look into it.
So there are three different types of change that can happen here. The first one is that investors can simply demand that their brokers route their orders to IEX and to exchanges which follow IEX-style architecture. And that will effectively solve Michael Lewis's problem right there. It needs no regulatory response at all. It's just a question of market behavior.
30 seconds for the other two.
Okay, and the other two are less useful. One is regulatory, and you can get around regulations quite easily. And the least useful would be criminal prosecutions around insider trading, and they would basically do no good at all.
Why not?
Because you're retroactively criminalizing a bunch of behavior which was actually encouraged by the SEC.
Is reading this book for some people going to be like watching House of Cards and inspired to become a politician as a result? In other words, are people going to get into this?
This happened with Michael Lewis's first book, with
Liar's Poker.
He meant it to be an expose of how dreadful Wall Street was, and everyone read it and wanted to become a bond trader.
All right. All you future front runners out there and everybody else, we thank Felix Salmon, finance blogger at Reuters, for explaining the Flash Boys landscape. Thanks a lot.